Live from CAF Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Mondays can feel a little sluggish, especially after a holiday. While some of us may have hit the pause button on news and current events, political momentum is picking up. This week, Governor Newsom will be taking on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in a debate moderated by Fox News' Sean Hannity. In the state legislature, the assembly has new positions in leadership, and the makeup of California's political weight in Congress, it's changing following the retirement of another longtime Congress member. Not to mention, the race for the Senate is gaining steam. There is a good amount to keep track of. Laura Cordy is co-author of Politico's California Playbook and joins us to get us up to speed on what's going on politically in the state and its impact on the national political landscape. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Vicky.
Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Oh, I had a great one. How about you?
I did too. Very full. Still full from Thursday.
Right. It's going to take a while to get through that.
Yeah. So we're going to dive into the changes in state leadership as well as a changing of the guard in congressional power in just a moment. But once again, Governor Newsom is going to take the national spotlight on Fox News. This time he's going to be debating Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in Georgia. As we know, both governors, it is known that they can take jabs at each other. They don't see eye
right.
on many issues. But what stands out to you about the format of having a debate?
Right. Well, this is a bit, you know, I think that Newsom's team has characterized this as a two against one kind of debate. It's moderated by Sean Hannity, the Fox News anchor, and obviously Ron DeSantis is conservative. And so there's certainly something to be said here about Newsom going into the lion's den. My colleague Christopher Catalago talked with Sean Hannity for a while. There's a new piece out from him today about what Hannity said to him. And, you know, Sean Hannity wants to come off as somebody who's very, equal. He wants to give equal treatment to both Ron DeSantis and Gavin Newsom. That's his kind of pledge. But it's going to be a little bit unusual. It's set in Alpharetta, Georgia. There's going to be no audience. And I think that this is a chance both for Ron DeSantis and Gavin Newsom to kind of play to their bases and jab at, as you alluded to, kind of reliable foils. They have a lot of, aside from their actual policy stances, they have a lot in common. They're both kind of these fledgling national figures. They're both trying to raise their profiles. They both have really strong stances on things like crime, LGBTQ issues, homelessness. And this is a chance to contrast themselves with, you know, somebody of the opposite party. So there's benefits for both, certainly.
Are there benefits for maybe California or even the Democratic Party outside of the individual potential political aspirations of Governor Newsom beyond being governor?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if there's a huge benefit to Californians directly other than maybe seeing, you know, their leader kind of, make Democrats proud, as it were. But, you know, Gavin Newsom's team has said that he intends to talk up President Joe Biden's record. This is not new. Newsom has been a surrogate for Biden on the campaign trail for a while. I think Newsom and some others in the Democratic Party very much see him as kind of injecting some new lifeblood into the party. At the same time, we're hearing complaints about Biden's age and about the relative age of the Democratic Party in general. There's a real, I think, hunger from some folks, especially younger voters, for somebody who's willing to stand up and take jabs and really get on the offensive, as it were, when it comes to the narrative. Gavin Newsom says this all the time, that Republicans are winning on the narrative. And so, I think there's a chance here for the Democratic Party to feel like they're punching back a little bit.
Yeah, and this also comes as the Democratic Party, I mean, they're also facing their share of internal challenges going into the holiday week at the California Democratic Convention in Sacramento. There were protests over the Israel-Hamas war. What stands out to you about the odds that are taking place within the party?
Right. I mean, this is one of the big dividing lines that's happening right now. As you mentioned, there were protests at the California Democratic Convention the other weekend. And where it has really shown up, I think, has been in the Senate race in California. You have Adam Schiff and Katie Porter and Barbara Lee, who have all been trying to define themselves over the past year as they're jockeying for, you know, the late Senator Dianne Feinstein's seat. And this has become one of the brighter lines between them. Barbara Lee has really worked to single herself out as somebody who is, you know, calling for a ceasefire, somebody who is not quite as, stalwartly pro-Israel as the other candidates. And so she's trying to align herself more with progressives and tell voters that she is the progressive choice on this issue at a time when there is so much dissent happening.
Yeah, what was also interesting is that convention could have ended up with an official party endorsement for a candidate for Senate, but that didn't happen. Why?
Right. Yeah. So the way that you can endorsements work at the convention is that you have to get 60% or more in order to win the official party endorsement. And so you had all three Senate candidates jockeying for that title. But nobody came up with 60%. Barbara Lee did get the most. She got a plurality of the votes. And her team really views that as a big win. There were lots of folks at the convention rallying for her. She got a huge round of applause when her name was said at convention. But the question is whether that plurality of endorsement votes is enough to really kickstart her campaign, which, as you know, she's been falling behind in the polls, you know, hanging around single digits, far behind Katie Porter and Adam Schiff for months now. Mm. So, there is a hope from her team that there's, you know, a new lifeblood that can be injected with this plurality of votes. But it remains to be seen.
It's also interesting that all three are Congress members. And so that could actually change the makeup of California's political weight in Congress, given all three are putting their names in the hat to run for Senate. I mean, that also follows some retirements of also longtime congressional leaders who are Californians. Right. I mean, what does this tell you about how California may be impacted with the national political weight in Congress?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. You think about the last couple of years. We had, of course, Kevin McCarthy recently as Speaker of the House. And prior to that, you know, Nancy Pelosi was a longtime heavyweight in Congress. And she still very much is, but obviously has taken a backseat to some of the leadership duties as she's, you know, continued on with her career. There's certainly a feeling that there's a bit of a changing of the guard in California's congressional delegation. You have a big wave of people that came through in the 90s and the early 2000s who are starting to retire. We saw that with Anna Eshoo recently, and before that, Tony Cardenas. And you have a number of folks who are simply deciding not to run for another term. In addition to these three members of Congress, you know, Katie Porter, Adam Schiff, and Barbara Lee, who are in, you know, pretty high profile districts, you know, for Adam Schiff and Barbara Lee, solidly blue districts, for Katie Porter, a purple district. And so you have these kind of open seats, a big swath of open seats for the first time in a while. And while it's unlikely to necessarily change the makeup of Congress itself, it certainly means a new generation of people for California.
Hmm. Has former Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, as it stands now, she's running, right, for re-election?
Yeah, she's running for re-election. We don't know when she's going to decide to retire. There's so many implications that come with her retirement, not the least of which is just her fundraising power. She is a huge boon for Democrats, especially this year when Democrats are trying to win back power in the House. But also her retirement would mean opening up this very competitive Democratic seat in San Francisco. There's a number of ambitious young Democrats who are really looking to get into that race. You know, some of the names we've heard as possibilities is State Senator Scott Wiener, who has really defined himself in Sacramento. Her daughter, Christine Pelosi, could be a contender. Whenever she does decide to step down, that's going to be a whole nother race. It's going to be a whole nother beast. So people are really interested to see when she decides to retire.
And I know that this is a couple years away, but there's already names in the gubernatorial race to replace Governor Newsom when he terms out. What stands out to you about who is announcing their candidacy so far? Even, you know, some others who are rumored to potentially announce it in the coming weeks or months.
Right. So the first announcement we got was Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounalakis, who, you know, came out way ahead of the pack. And Eleni Kounalakis has significant statewide name ID. She also has a lot of money, which when it comes to these kind of races, you know, can't be understated. It's hard to win a statewide in general, but especially in California with 40 million voters and a lot of ground to cover, you really have to have a good war chest. What's interesting to me is that she entered the race, but she didn't clear the field. Shortly after, we heard some rumblings from Attorney General Rob Bonta that he might like to enter the race. He hasn't officially launched yet. Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond has launched a race for governor. We're hearing that maybe Senate Pro Tem Tony Atkins might want to run as well. And so I think what's notable about that is you do have this kind of front runner, Eleni Kounoulakis, who has a lot of money and a lot of name ID, but people aren't necessarily intimidated out of running against her. So I think it's going to be really interesting. You have a lot of ambitious Democrats looking to succeed Gavin Newsom and no real clear successor yet. So that's going to be a very interesting race when it gets underway.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Laura Cordy, co-author of Politico's California Playbook, about the latest in the political world. So there's also a change in leadership when it comes to the state legislature. I was reading this morning's California Playbook, which you co-authored, and you were talking about the new committee chair appointments in the state assembly by Speaker Robert Rivas. This also is going to be Speaker Rivas's really first full session governing this body.
Right.
What did his selections say to you about how he will lead?
Right. Well, we knew that Robert Rivas had a lot of mouths to feed when it comes to these committee appointments. I'm sure folks remember that last year earlier this year, you know, he ran this campaign to unseat Anthony Rendon. There was a lot of animosity in that kind of campaign. There were some dividing lines, some resentments held. And so the fact that there were folks who were on Robert Rivas's side meant that he had, you know, a lot of folks to reward. And so with these committee appointments, he certainly did that, appointing some of his top allies to the big committee chairmanships. You have Jesse Gabriel, who is going to be head of the budget committee. That's a huge appointment. You have Buffy Wicks, the Bay Area lawmaker, who is head of appropriations. One notable thing when it comes to these changes is that he demoted one of his top allies, Los Angeles lawmaker Isaac Bryan. He was majority floor leader and is now head of the Natural Resources Committee. That is significant because it says something about, you know, Robert Rivas willing to kind of make tough choices when he feels like it necessitates it. In this case, this was a close friend and a close ally that he felt, you know, no longer served that position. And that's tough. I think that that shows a bit of a willingness to be, you know, slightly unpopular, to make some tough choices. But we have yet to hear exactly how much power he's willing to give committee chairs, and that's really key. As it stands, committee chairs can decide what bills live and die, and that's caused some problems over the past year, with the wider caucus being upset that, you know, one person is the gatekeeper for legislation that the rest of them like. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if there's autonomy given to these leaders or if they're, you know, expected to fall in line behind Rivas. Mm.
And also Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, who's also running for mayor in the city of Sacramento, he received an appointment as well.
Right. Kevin McCarty is going to be head of the Public Safety Committee while he's running for Sacramento mayor. And I was very interested to see who would get that committee, just because over the last year, it has been such a source of, I want to say, headaches and contention for Democrats. You know, they've had some contentious legislation around fentanyl and public safety and human trafficking go through that committee. And it's really caused some problems for Democrats who are a little bit more moderate, feeling like they have to answer for the progressive stances of some of their colleagues. And so Kevin McCarty is going to have to preside over some really tough and really emotional battles, too. And, you know, I'm really interested to see what he does with that committee.
There was also the announcement going into the holiday that the chair of the California Democratic Party, Rusty Hicks, is going to be running for a state assembly seat in District 2. That's the North Coast. So it spans like Sonoma County all the way up to Eureka. What stands out to you about this move, moving from potentially the chair of the Democratic Party to state leadership?
Yeah, you know, I was just talking to somebody about this. Rusty Hicks has been around for a long time, and as you mentioned, chair of the Democratic Party. I don't believe he's ever been elected to a formal position, so I think there's certainly a difference between leading the kind of tone and tenor of the party versus actually enacting policy. He is going to be running for the seat, I believe the region currently held by Assemblymember Jim Wood, who announced he is not going to run for re-election. But what that does is set off, you know, some jockeying for leader of the California Democratic Party, which, you know, party leadership is always a big deal, but especially in California, where Democrats just dominate and tend to have such a presence on the national stage, that's an incredibly important position. And, you know, when that election comes up, it's certainly going to be a tense one. Mm.
In the last like 20 seconds or so that we have, you know, in the final weeks of 2023, anything else that you're going to be closely following that we missed?
Oh, I'm just, you know, eager to see what Gavin Newsom does with Ron DeSantis. I'm also eager to see, you know, December 8th is the filing deadline for re-election. And so you might see some people drop out. You might see some people get in. There's still time.
Laura Cordy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Vicky.
Laura is the co-author of Politico's California Playbook, getting us up to speed on all the latest happenings in the political world. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. At the height of the pandemic, protections were put in place on both the local and state level to keep millions of people from losing housing. And this was at a time when many were just unable to work in the spirit of public health. But these eviction protections were far from perfect, and they came with pushback from landlord groups about having to financially shoulder the brunt of these economic challenges. Now we're seeing the consequences of that strain. CalMatters took a look at data across the state and found that in the year since pandemic-era renter protections largely ended, evictions across the state have dramatically increased. And some eviction rates, including in Sacramento County, have surpassed levels before the pandemic. Jeannie Kwong is a reporter with CalMatters and has been analyzing this rise in eviction case filings and joins us now about what this means for both landlords and renters. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with some quick background, because a lot has happened, you know, in the nearly 4 years since, you know, a stay-at-home order was put in place. So the eviction moratorium was really widespread across California following the governor's executive order, which officially declared a state of emergency during the pandemic. What impact did this have for renters across California?
Yeah, the eviction moratorium was statewide. It went through June 2022, so more than 2 years, and it essentially halted or put a pause on eviction cases that had to do with non-payment of rent if the tenant said that they couldn't pay due to financial impacts from the pandemic. And that just went on for quite a while. And then there were also several cities and counties that had their own protections kick in after June 2022. And a lot of those sort of slowly started expiring earlier this year. So now we're seeing case filings in those places really spike since their moratoria ended.
Wait, when that was actually put in place, because this spanned over 2 years, was this just a blanket ban on evictions?
No, there were a few months towards the beginning where it was closer to that. And then for the most part, it was just on non-payment cases. And so there were other filings of evictions and thousands of people were evicted during that period of time under some of the other exceptions that you could. For example, if you said that you were doing substantial renovations to the home or something like that. But for the most part, the moratorium that limited non-payment of rent cases, it did drop eviction filings to record lows for those 2 years. Mm.
Given that renter protections have existed prior to the pandemic in California, how was this moratorium different?
Well, most eviction case filings are for the non-payment of rent. So this, you know, the limits really took out a substantial portion of those types of cases.
Mm. You know, before the pandemic, how common were evictions in California?
Eviction filings were steadily dropping from like a really high level in the years following the Great Recession. And then I looked at about 10 years of data, and they were really year after year on average steadily dropping across the state. And I think what's concerning about the past year is that we might be seeing a reversal of that trend now. I think I would want to wait for, you know, another few months or another year of data to see long term what's happening. But it is kind of an interesting reversal that we might be seeing right now.
So you've been seeing an increase or even a spike in eviction filings across the state. I mean, how does that shape up? You looked at like more than a dozen of the largest counties in California.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I want to kind of add the caveat. These are eviction case filings, so it doesn't necessarily mean that the person got locked out, but it starts the clock on a you know, process in court where somebody could get evicted or they could perhaps like agree to move out as part of a settlement. So, most places that had the moratorium end last summer saw a spike in filings last fall. So maybe about a year ago around this time. And then in some of the smaller counties, those numbers have kind of evened out or maybe even dipped a little below the pre-pandemic average from 2019. And then in some of the counties that did have protections that lasted longer than the statewide moratorium, those are now seeing their spikes in case filings, you know, a few months after their local moratorium ended. So everybody is experiencing a spike right after whatever moratorium applies to their county ends. And then there were also a few counties that I thought were significant in that they had the statewide moratorium end over a year ago, didn't have any additional moratoria in their local cities or counties, and they're still seeing elevated numbers and compared to, you know, the 2019 pre-pandemic average. And some of those places include Santa Clara County, Contra Costa County, and also Sacramento County.
So obviously this moratorium was put in place to protect renters from losing housing. But what did you learn from landlords or property owners about how it impacted them? Because some still had to pay mortgage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think many landlords, perhaps even most landlords that you talk to, they'll say that those moratoria were overly broad. You know, kind of everybody has these anecdotes from their own experiences, whether it was the rental assistance from the state being slow to come through to them, or, you know, they would say that the economy had already kind of recovered by a certain point and they had tenants who were working or appeared to have income and yet were not paying. And so some landlords were saying that these moratorias kind of gave them no recourse when they themselves were also, you know, not making their income here.
Given that you've been following this for quite some time, you know, once the moratoria expired, whether at the state or the local level, were you surprised that eviction case filings increased, or was this something that you anticipated?
No, I don't think anybody should be that surprised to see some increase in cases. I think the more surprising part is, like I said, in those areas that didn't have any limits for a while now, that we haven't seen those numbers peter out in some of these counties. Like I said, Santa Clara County, Sacramento County, you know, these areas are still seeing elevated filings despite the quote unquote return to normal more than a year ago. Elevated, by that I mean compared to pre-pandemic averages. So I think that is kind of surprising, and I'd like to kind of watch how long it takes for those numbers to return to normal, if at all.
What stands out to you about Sacramento County? Because they're an outlier in this, at least currently when looking at 2023. It was, as you mentioned, Santa Clara County as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know kind of the granular level details of each county and why things might remain elevated. But, you know, one of the suggestions that tenant advocates said might drive some of these increases is current rent increases. You know, rent, we know that because of inflation from the past year, rent has been allowed to increase more than it normally did under state tenant protection laws. So that could be part of what's driving increased inability by tenants on tenants' parts to not be able to afford rent in certain places. That might be part of it. And then there are also some areas that have a right to counsel for tenants to get a lawyer that's paid for by the public to help defend them in eviction court, and that doesn't exist here. So you don't have that guaranteed defense, and it is very easy without an attorney to lose a case.
Can all of this be solely attributed to the pandemic, or are there other factors at play that's contributing to this?
Well, I definitely think because the moratorium went on for so long, and that was because of the pandemic, you know, whatever, I think that might have lasting effects on the rental market. Another thing is that as the moratoria were expiring over the past year, a bunch of other programs were expiring as well. And those were also from the pandemic. But a lot of those programs, whether it's expanded food stamp benefits, kind of loosened eligibility, so to speak, for the Medi-Cal health program. There was a lot of aid during the pandemic that kept families afloat during all this economic turmoil. And a lot of that was also expiring along with record inflation in the past year as these moratoria were expiring. So it could be that all of these things were kind of happening at the same time.
Yeah, like a cascading impact.
Yeah.
You know, I was also looking at your numbers, you know, because Sacramento County was an outlier on having a higher increase in eviction case filings. But others in our area, like San Joaquin County and Stanislaus County, they fared better. They're actually like in a negative percentile. I mean, was that surprising to you, given that they are neighboring counties?
Yeah, it was kind of surprising. There are some areas that remain or kind of maybe never even returned to pre-pandemic levels. Some of the smaller counties. That kind of happened across the board in the smaller counties that I looked at.
When you talked to landlord groups, property owners, I mean, what did you learn about the argument for filing these eviction cases?
Yeah, I heard a lot of things. Most of them said that this is just kind of catching up from the past few years for people who, you know, either they were unable to qualify for rental assistance to pay those rent arrears or just weren't paying rent during that time. And then I've also heard that there were many cases that piled up that had to do with, you know, behavioral issues or other kinds of reasons for wanting to evict a tenant that they were kind of felt like they were unable to serve during the moratoria. It just seems like there was a lot of misunderstanding on all parts about like whether or not you had to pay rent, whether or not you could evict anyone for any reason. And so a lot of the landlord groups are saying this is just kind of catch up and it will even out after a few months after the moratoria end. And so I guess we'll see.
So it may just be, you know, a relatively immediate spike that will level off and not really signifying more of a continued upward trend.
You know, that's what I kind of thought would be the case in most places. But because there are those areas that where the filings do remain elevated, I think we'll have to wait and see.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jeannie Kwong, a reporter with CalMatters, about spikes in the rate of eviction filings in some California counties since COVID-era moratoriums were lifted. I mean, Jeannie, and I know you're aware of this, this also comes as California is grappling with a growing unhoused population. We saw the largest increase of homelessness than any other state during a period that included the pandemic. What impact could these case filings have on this?
Yeah, there was a national social sciences study from earlier this year that found that an uptick in eviction case filings, they associated it with a slight uptick in the population of homeless people living in shelters. So it's definitely, it can be for many people like the kind of first step towards becoming unhoused to be evicted. And then the other thing is that people who lose in eviction court, so these case filings are all sealed, but people who lose in eviction court have that eviction on their record. And that makes it, you know, especially in a tight rental market, mm-hmm. makes it really hard to find housing again.
I mean, you were just mentioning even during the moratoria, it was a confusing process to know, you know, what your rights were as a renter or as a landlord. I would imagine the legal process surrounding an eviction case filing can also be complicated. What did you learn about how people are navigating this via the court system?
Yeah, I mean, you have to respond within 5 days if you're served with a case filing. And from what I heard from tenants' attorneys, of which there are very few across the state, it's just a very fast timetable from their end as the defendant in the case. And if you kind of don't know to respond right away or can't make it by that deadline, it all kind of spirals from there. So I think it's a very formal legal process that maybe a lot of people don't understand. And once you're faced with that court case, you know, you sort of have to start making a deal with your landlord. And you do that in this sort of informal conversation outside the courtroom with them. And if you kind of can't reach a deal right then and there, you know, outside the courtroom, you go to trial and it's up to a judge. And so I have heard from some tenants that it feels like a process that's designed to pressure them. And then from on the other side, you know, if you're a landlord and you have a need to get someone out or to kind of force someone to start paying rent or something, yeah, it's leverage. You know, you file a case and you get this formal forum in which you're finally, you know, able to use the law to force this person to start doing something that you need them to do. And so, you know, it's a formal process and it's there for a reason. But, you know, many people do feel that especially on the tenant side, that it is kind of imbalanced, especially because most of them show up without lawyers.
Why is that? Because you mentioned there's not enough attorneys to represent tenants.
Yeah. Most of the tenants' attorneys work for legal aid organizations, which are generally a bit understaffed. But it's expensive to hire a lawyer, and most people who are renting don't have that kind of income for that.
Does an eviction always mean that someone will lose housing, or are there less severe outcomes?
No, you don't. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get locked out of the house, but it does kind of start this court process, as I mentioned. And so you can reach an agreement with your landlord when you're in court to either, you know, maybe you can set up a payment plan and agree, okay, I'll pay this amount by this certain date and then I can stay. Or a lot of people also have an agreement where they settle and they agree to move out by a certain date. And that's known in the kind of tenant world as informal evictions. And a lot of those happen too. It's really hard to see from our numbers how many ended in a formal lockout versus ended in one of those agreements. And then also it's hard to tell when somebody does reach one of those agreements, you know, if they're able to meet it and if they're able to stay or not, like what the outcome of that agreement is too. So it is sort of hard to tell from the numbers, but there's a number of different outcomes. Some of them can involve staying. Some of them can involve agreeing to move out.
Mm. Are there still programs available, any resources or support locally or statewide?
For the most part, the statewide rental assistance program, you had to apply by March of last year for rental arrears, like before that. And then they are still processing those applications too. Like, not everybody has gotten their money from that program, and a lot of people are still waiting for it. But most of that aid was all tied to the pandemic and has largely run out or is on track to run out.
Jeannie, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Jeannie Kwong is a reporter with CalMatters, sharing her reporting on the dramatic rise in eviction filings across California over the past year since the expiration of pandemic-era relief programs. Still ahead, if you enjoy curling up to a good book, NPR has come out with its annual Books We Love Selections, and it's an interactive guide. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For those who enjoy reading or listening to a new book but have trouble committing to just one, there is an assist to relieve choice paralysis while combing through a bookstore. That is me. For the past decade, NPR has curated its Books We Love. It's an interactive guide that is a reading guide based on staff and critic selections of their top picks of the year. And the 2023 edition is now live. There are nearly 400 books to choose from, and that can feel intimidating, but you can mix and match tags such as book club ideas, biography, memoir, or eye-opening reads to filter those results and find the book that's in line with your literary tastes or as a gift for someone else. I spoke with Andrew Limbong, NPR's Arts Desk reporter and Book of the Day podcast host, about the work that went into this year's interactive guide with a real-time demonstration to boot. Well, Andrew, you know, given that you host NPR's Book of the Day, you know, I have a pretty envious question to ask you. Do you have like a running tally of books that you enjoy, you know, in a week, month or year?
Oh, OK. Listen, so in my defense, I like just had a kid. So those numbers like plummeted right down. Let me tell you, I hit the gutter. The great thing about NPR's Book of the Day podcast is that it collects all of the interviews that we do at NPR. So all of the host interviews that we do on Morning Edition or All Things Considered or stuff like that. And so it's a way of like capturing these interviews to make sure that they don't just sort of get lost in the grind of like the daily news, you know, as you know, tends to happen sometimes. And it's a way of getting people to sort of like pay attention to some interviews that you might have missed and like get some book recommendations. And so That's a long way of saying I'm very heavily reliant on the hosts and producers of the respective shows.
Have you always loved a good read, or did it come with age as you got older?
So older how? Like, I remember hating reading when I was a kid, but my mom like locked me in a room with a book and was like, "You're not coming out until you finish this book." Which, you know, I will not, you know, neither advocate for that parenting style or whatever, but it seemed to have worked. Yeah. And so, yeah, I was like a lit major in college and all that stuff growing up. And so like the whole goal was to be a professor of like William Faulkner or something like that.
Awesome. Well, you know, I love like wandering around a bookstore, but I also get overwhelmed with what to select. So that makes your interactive Books We Love guide, I mean, that's just like a welcome relief for someone like myself. How did you go about curating this list?
Yeah, so Books We Love is this annual guide that we put out every year. That we've been doing it for over a decade now. And what happens is, like, around the fall, we send a call out to all of our staff and all of our book critics and the reporters and stuff like that and say, hey, what books have you loved? What books do you really want to talk about? Let us know what you've been reading. And then after that, you know, massive wave of books comes in, we, you know, gather together and shout out to everyone else who works on this, because it is a work of many. Just do a bunch of like long meetings in Excel spreadsheets, sort of like cataloging all these books and sort of making sure what goes on there and what doesn't. And I think what's important to point out, it's a conversation, right? It isn't a one directional word from on high saying, here's the 10 best books of the year. It is, here's 350 plus books that you might be interested in if you want to know about XYZ. And we have a long list of filters of categories that you can then use to sort of pick out, to narrow the list down and find out what you might want to read next. Because yeah, choice paralysis is definitely a real thing. And this helps greatly with that.
Yeah, I mean, and even like hearing you have over 300 book selections, which is awesome. And you've broken them up into a wide range of topics for all literary tastes and ages. How do you want people to experience this guide?
So what I usually do is, because all the great thing about it is it collects all of the books we love we've done going back to 2013. So if I want to, you know, figure out anything going back then, I just use the format and so use the platform. And so what I usually do is like go to the Books We Love platform and then figure out what mood I'm in, right? So if I want to read something more like literary, I can go to CRC Great Writing. And then if I want to read about more realistic fiction, I can then use that to find out what's realistic and under Seer Secret Writing. And then my favorite tag is actually the rather long and rather short tags. So then I can narrow that down to the rather short. So, and now I just did all that and I've got a collection of, what is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 books that I can then like choose from there.
Oh, that is way more manageable. And that definitely, yeah, I think, helps prevent, you know, choice paralysis. I want to dive into some of the genres that you have. I mean, it was a pretty decent or good year for memoirs and biographies. Which are your favorites?
Let me go on to the Books We Love and go to memoirs and biographies and let you know.
I love the live demonstration.
Yeah, I mean, this is it in real time. I mean, we gotta, like, you can't not shout out the Britney Spears book. I think like having I was a big part of the coverage when all of the hullabaloo around her conservatorship was going on, and so like finally like that book coming out, it was like of you know, of pertinent interest to me. The other biography that I had actually blurbed about was this book called Ringmaster. It's a biography of Vince McMahon, who is the head of the WWE, by Abraham Josephine Reisman. And what's great about, I don't know if you're a wrestling head.
A little bit when I was a kid, but it's been a minute.
Yeah, what's great about this is that it's not just a book about Vince and like wrestling, but it's about how this sort of idioms of wrestling can be translated into a culture today, right? And so this idea of like a heel, of pretending to be a loudmouth bad guy in order to gain attention, and how that works, really, you know, you can see the pattern work in wrestling, right? And seeing how people sort of exploit the attention economy using these different methods, you kind of be like, oh wow, I see that online, I see that in politics, I see that in like discourse, I just see it everywhere now. And so it's a really interesting look at culture today.
I also have friends, they love fantasy and sci-fi. What do you suggest?
I mean, if you haven't read The Fourth Wing, that's the big one, right? Like, have you read it?
No, I have not read it. I have heard about it, though, and people have recommended it.
Yeah, I mean that's the big one. If you want something a little more under the radar that isn't like all over TikTok these days, CPAM Zhang's like Land of Milk and Honey is a more like literary stuff with some sci-fi elements twisted in. There's like Elizabeth Acevedo's Family Lore has fantasy elements within its sort of more lit ficky type things. The Adventures of Amina El Serafi is actually a fun book about like a retired pirate who's got to go in for one last job. And the interview that we did with that book is really fun.
That's great. You, when it comes to children's books, what rose to the top for you this year?
I think there's a couple of kids books that are really interesting. Henry, Like Always, by Jen Bailey and illustrated by Mika Song. I think so. The main character, Henry, you know, shows characteristics that imply that he's on the spectrum, right? Which I don't think gets a lot of play or a lot of coverage isn't the right word. A lot of representation in kids' books that I've seen. And, you know, like I said, I've been reading a lot of kids' books lately, and it's not something that I've seen a lot. Yeah, and all that. So that's a really interesting book. Another one for kids who maybe is Who to F Cares by Huda Fahmy. It's a sequel to our book, Who to F Are You? And that's a very, like, jolly, rambunctious book for maybe, like, kids with a little, like, sharper elbows.
You know, all of this sounds great, and then I'm able to narrow it down to like a handful of books, which is awesome. It's one thing to choose a book for yourself. It can also be a little more daunting or challenging selecting a book for someone else, and we are rounding the corner to the holidays. How do you go about gifting a book?
So like I try to get a book for my father-in-law every year now and then, because you know that's what dad's you know, that's okay. And so, yeah, he likes, you know, biography stuff, right? So I'll click on that. He's like a music guy, so I'm clicking on that. I'm just doing this in real time right now. And so cross-referencing that is, I'll probably pick up like the Lou Reed book by Will Hermes. It's a Lou Reed, King of New York. And literally just like using that. It's like using the filters to find out what your gift givee is interested in.
I love the real-time demonstration, Andrew. Okay, I know we have to wrap up. One last question. It's the hardest question. I saved it for last. Do you have a favorite book of 2023?
Favorite one of my, I just went on this long spiel about how this is a democratic platform and no worries. But I think the book I think about the most, I've been thinking about the most this year, is a graphic novel by Jillian Tamaki and Mariko Tamaki called Roaming. And it's about these three, I think they're college freshmen from Canada who come to New York City for just like their first big trip away. And they're you know, it's 2009, they're 19 years old. And they are filled with all the feelings you are filled with when you're 19. And it's a really tender look at friendship and what that means at that age that I found really touching.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for making the process a lot easier for us book lovers.
Yeah, thank you.
Andrew Limbong is NPR's Arts Desk reporter and Book of the Day podcast host, talking about this year's Books We Love, an interactive reading guide based on staff and critic selections of their top picks of the year. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to email us, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Monday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.